We do not have a quorum, but we're going to start the testimony, and I, if there are people here interested in the autism part of this bill, we're going to deal with that starting at whenever we get back from session and our caucuses. My guess is that would be around 3 o'clock, and the first thing we will do at that time is have testimony on the autism issue. So if you're here for that issue, and you can sit here and watch all this if you want, but you can also go out and have a long lunch and come back at 3 o'clock. And I have to leave. I have a bill up in another committee at 9:30, so somebody else will be running the meeting while I'm gone. Shouldn't take very long. What? No, I said we don't have one. So, first on the agenda is Cyril Den from Mankato. And we're going to... And I should say that, you know, we have about 90 people signed up to talk, so that if you could keep it around 3 minutes, we'd really appreciate it.
Okay, I'll try to do that, Representative Huntley. But Reginald and I signed up for this. I had two other people that was going to help me, but because of the time constraints, I'm going to try to include their notes. Originally, the reason for my public testimony is that the original proposal was for a 2.5% reduction in long-term care nursing homes. My understanding, that's been reduced to 1% now.
It's 1% for 1 year only, and then it'll be reinstated in the next plan.
Also, at this time, you're not considering the proposed repeal on rate equity, but I'll still make one comment about that. Myself, I had personal experience with home health care. I had a serious car accident August 28, 2005. I was not released from the hospital until March 8, 2006, 6 months, 11 days. At times in the following 3.5 years, because of additional surgeries, I had as many as 3 nurses that had to come to my home every 8 hours to change my wounds, give me shots, things like that. This was a requirement by my doctor at the hospital that I have 3. Guess what? Insurance would only cover 2. Did I want to stay in the hospital when I could get a nurse for $50 an hour for myself? No. I'd already been there 6 months. I already outlasted probably most of the people that would have normally gone through that kind of an accident. But I still question, you know, is that cost effective? When it goes from the hospital to the long-term care or to the home health care. The fact that staying in the hospital obviously is more expensive than either one. But those were the requirements. When the doctors dropped it down to 2 nurses per day, guess what? Again, I had to pay for 1. On the home health care, that's my version. Anyway, I had a sister at the time who was... confined to Hillcrest Nursing Home in Mankato, Minnesota for approximately 1.5 years. She had had several serious bouts of pneumonia, and December 8, 2005, 2 months after I went in the hospital, she died. I already knew while visiting her before my accident in the nursing home that I saw understaffing, loss of quality care, and constantly changing of employees. I call it the revolving door of employees, birth nurse, nursing aides, and RNs. This constant training and supervision that must have been required to train these employees and then see them leave for a better job has to be difficult for nursing home administrators. I received some of this information from an assistant at the Thrill Nursing Home Companies, and she was a nursing administrator for them up till about 2 years ago when she retired. It is hard to attract and keep quality health care workers, especially for long-term care, nursing home, and home health care. When a position at the hospital opens up and these nurses can make $15,000 to $20,000 per year more, would you stay as an employee of a long-term care nursing home, or would you go to the hospital? I received this information through a friend of mine who was originally an assistant, nursing assistant, for about 10 years in a nursing home. She went on to get her RN while she was working there. She was offered $23 an hour as an RN. She now works at a hospital in Mankato for $35 an hour. When you're almost making 60% more, again, where would you work? How do we keep quality health care workers for those in great need, those in nursing homes who are, and those who are trying to stay home as long as possible before hopefully not having to go to a nursing home? How do we keep a decent level of care to our seniors, the frail and the elderly? Certainly not by reducing payments to long-term care nursing homes and home health care. I understand the budgets, and the problem is from what I understand, they've only had 2.5% increases twice in the last 10 years. Last year, you knocked them 2.5. This year, it's 1%. Now we might be at 2.5 again next year. They have lost in the last 10 years. How many of you can say you're making the same salary you did 10 years ago?
We do.
Okay. Someday this.
Let me interrupt you a minute there. We're going to call the committee to order so you can at least have a moment to be ahead of us. Officially, we have a quorum.
Okay.
And if you could kind of complete your remarks, that would be helpful. I think it's been very helpful having you here, sir. So.
Okay, again, for those that had just joined, my name is Cy Denham from the Mankato area, and I'm submitting this as my own personal testimony. Someday, this will affect us. It will either affect your parent, your spouse, a family member, a dear friend who must be in a long-term nursing home facility. Approximately 1 out of 3 of those 65 or over will spend some time in a nursing home. I used to sell health insurance for 30 years. I was an insurance business and then became a financial planner. So I was already in favor of, even though I'm, quote, a GOP-leaning person, I vote both sides. But the point is I was in favor of it since 1990. I was in South Dakota in 92 through, well, in 83 through 96. 93 and 94, I was on Tom Daschle's committee in South Dakota. He had 3 different committees for input, both citizens, people from the insurance industry, people from doctors, administrators, chiropractors, you name it. But he had 3 different committees. I don't like the idea of the government totally taking over, but yet at the same time, the insurance companies have had 16 years of warnings, and they never changed. So, again, no senior wants to go to a nursing home. They wish to stay in their home as long as possible, which is most cost-effective, a long-term care nursing home or home health care. I know you've Mr. dropped the rate equity.
Dan, if you can kind of wrap it up.
Yep, this would be it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Again, you're dropping the rate equity. If in the future this comes forward to you, I want you to think about this also. Rate equity says it all. Equal cost for state pay and private pay, period.
Thank you very much for coming. And I just want to make a comment as I take over the chair for a moment here. There's 60-some people scheduled to be here. If everybody takes 10 minutes, that's 600 minutes, which would be a long time. And so thank you for coming, Mr. Dan. And so if, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, you can usually get most of your idea across, and there'd be some flexibility. But, you know, if when you write letters, if I have more time, I would have written it shorter. A lot of us know the topics. If you could kind of talk about the bill that's in front of us, about specifics to that, that would help us. And I would just tell you ahead of time that there's not many people on this committee who are really happy with the bill that's in front of us. So, so we share your concerns about all this, so you don't have to persuade us about that. So with that, hello, Ms. Henry, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at the Legal Aid Society. I want to briefly touch on 5 areas this morning. First, I want to thank you for the governor's proposed cuts that you did not include in this bill, especially the MFIP SSI cuts, the cash general assistance, MSA special needs, and nursing facility rate equalization. Second, we appreciate that some of the governor's cuts were moderated in this bill. First, a significant moderation of provider rate cuts, that's important. Second, we're very happy that rehab services were not eliminated, though we are sorry to see that specialized maintenance is. We think that's the wrong direction as we're trying to get complex people to function better. And third, we very, very much appreciate the improvements to MA dental care for adults and the fact that the state-operated dental clinics are going to remain. Third area, we continue to oppose cuts to the home and community waivers. We've had very significant cuts to these disability waiver programs over 7 of the last 8 years, and it is showing mightily out there in the community. Second, we're very concerned about the mental health grant cuts that we were not aware of before this bill, and I just want to focus on the children's grants. These grants have been touted as the alternative to the many children with mental health problems that will be cut or eliminated altogether from PCA services. So we've got a big problem here. In fact, just last week in Senator Berglund's committee, we were told about these as alternatives as we're learning about all the kids that are cut off of PCA services coming up. This is a big problem. We are also concerned about the county CCSA cuts. A lot of people with disabilities that are getting county paid services across Minnesota will suffer because of these cuts. Also, the MAEPD premium increases for medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. We were very sorry to see this newly in the bill. We think this may run into problems under the federal requirements to not increase premiums for medical assistance. So we'll keep that in mind as this moves ahead. And finally, in this area of problems, the increase to $12 out-of-pocket prescription drug coverage. This is going to cause problems for people with those personal needs allowance of $89. And sadly, those folks just lost $12 that they had to pay for this starting April 1st from cuts that were made last year. How ironic. Fourth area is that we strongly support early expansion of medical assistance for adults without children. As we move forward, we really urge that we recall the people with disabilities and seniors are eligible for medical assistance, many of them also at 75% of the poverty level, and they have a $3,000 asset limit, which really impoverishes them and means we have to add other services because we take away their Social Security. So hopefully we can make some changes as we move ahead with federal reform in that area. And the final area I want to touch on is that the payment reform demonstration, intensive care management provisions, and the accountable care organization provisions are significant provisions to try to change the way medical care is delivered. We think that's a good idea, especially the accountable care organization, though it looks like it could take everybody in 2 years on medical assistance, and we think it needs more involvement of stakeholders, transparency, and some parameters. We have learned some things in Minnesota over the last 15 years by paying on a capitated basis for complex people in the Minnesota Disability Health Options Program, which is ending now, and special needs basic care and the MCHO for seniors. And we've got to learn or use what we've learned and reflect on that. I just mentioned three things. Risk adjustment, it is akin to rocket science, and we need to get it right for complex people. Many persons with disabilities, our clients, are treated for their disability. They have what's called a lot of deferred maintenance in the healthcare area, and it will take time and investment to turn that cost trajectory for them, so we need to keep our expectations match what we learned in the past. And the last point is that the long-term community support services ought not be provided on the medical model. It is too expensive, the staff are too expensive, and it is too restrictive. Coordination for those community support services with healthcare, yes. Control, no. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Speaking of rocket scientists, welcome Ms. Regan to the committee. She was talking about it's not rocket, it is rocket science.
It was a compliment.
Welcome to the committee. Actually, as you're, there's a list of people here, so as the next person notices they're up, why don't you just kind of do the alternating chair thing? That'll help, too. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is an association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. And if we were strictly a trade association, I probably would not be here today because I think many of the cuts proposed in this budget will be a benefit to the businesses of my membership. However, we're also an advocacy organization, and we do have concerns in particular in three different areas. The first being in the CCSA cuts. As I've testified before, 72% of these dollars are spent on children. This fund lost $50 million in 2003 when this consolidated grant was created. The governor unallotted $16.9 million in 2010, $22.5 million in 2011, and this proposal cuts an additional $9.9 million, which is a 42% cut to the CCSA fund. Over 5,400 children were victims of abuse and neglect in Minnesota in 2008. 45 children suffered life-threatening injuries, and 17 children died. The state dollars contained in the CCSA grants are the only state dollars that we put into these services in Minnesota, the only state dollars that go to counties. The cuts to school-linked mental health services and other grants are also of particular concern. They're tipping points for families and communities that, when reached, require that children be removed and placed for treatment or protection. And those tipping points are most often the capacity of a school or family to maintain children with serious mental health or behavioral problems. Eliminating the school-linked mental health grants eliminates funding for services that can intervene and help children before their problems escalate to the point where they need placement. The cuts in respite care grants for families, as Ms. Henry mentioned, when paired with the changes to the PCA program, mean many children will not be able to be maintained at home. The majority of children currently receiving PCA services are children with mental health and behavior problems, and these children will lose eligibility for PCA services next year, and now 50% fewer families will have access to respite care. Finally, the changes to MFIP. The majority of MFIP recipients are children. If we push families further into poverty, we create the conditions which lead to potential abuse and neglect. And the majority of the children removed from their homes for child protection are removed for neglect. These most vulnerable children and families are still upstream. Without protection and early intervention, they are the future clients of our mental health, corrections, chemical dependency, and homeless services. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Regan. Ms. Carter and then Judy Brumfield can come. You have a question? Representative Mary, we have a question for you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's not really a question but a comment, and it's for Ms. Regan and the testifiers before her and for the testifiers that come after. It's awkward, I think, for me as a legislator to say it is important that you are clear about the things that are going to happen to people as a result of the cuts in this bill. And I'm glad that so many people are here to testify today and to bear witness to what is happening as a result of the ongoing cuts in Health and Human Services because we can't raise revenue under the current administration. And so this is going to be my refrain for the day. What's happening is real, and it's impacting real people, and I'm sure my colleagues are going to pipe up on this as well. So it's hard to listen to your testimony, but I want you to be clear about the impacts that are going to happen to people as a result of the cuts. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Ms. Carter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tony Carter, Ramsey County Commissioner, and here representing the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I'd like to briefly comment on the House bill and then turn to Judith Brumfield, who will make some additional comments and give more detail on behalf of our county. First of all, I'd like to express appreciation for the difficult task that you've had this year and in years past, bearing such as you have such a large share of the state's budget problems in this committee. As a commissioner, I am aware of the tough choices that you're making and that you are seeking, as we all are, a balance between needs and wants and also between investments and emergencies. And counties appreciate that this budget, in spite of many painful reductions, does attempt to preserve a safety net for those who are in need. And moreover, it contains opportunities to reform and to invest in ideas that, if successfully executed into the future, will actually result and better health and human services outcomes and cost containment. So I want to comment on the following areas of the budget: early Medicaid expansion, particularly the Accountable Care Organization proposal, CCSA, SHIP, general assistance, mental health grant reductions, and mental health cost share. First of all, regarding the early Medicaid expansion, counties believe that the expansion and the Accountable Care Organization proposal is far preferable to the GAMC fix bill that ultimately passed and was signed by the governor. This proposal provides for a more clearly defined benefit set, for a manageable payment rate, and for accountability in caring for low-income adults. We all know that for GAMC-eligible individuals, access to health care, though important and necessary, is not sufficient to assure health. Often these individuals need housing, care coordination, and other supports to stay on medication, to manage chronic health problems, and to engage in overall healthy behaviors. Our locally based and county based purchasing organizations provide a great example of the coordination that can exist between the county as a health plan, local health care providers, and public health and social services. But non-county-based purchasing counties also welcome the opportunity to work toward creating ACOs with community-based partners and with the state. I want to express appreciation on behalf of the counties for your having left the SHIP funding in place. The statewide health improvement program is exciting in that many things are happening in our local communities that will foster healthy lifestyles, and we hope that it will not be long before we actually see the payoff of that investment. Minnesota's foresight in this area is being validated now by the federal health reform's emphasis on health improvement and, in particular, on the prevention of childhood obesity. I have a letter from our AMC affiliate, the local public health association, that will provide more detail along this response. Also, thank you for leaving general assistance program intact rather than converting it to an emergency-only assistance as proposed by the governor. While this reduction did not affect county property taxpayers directly, the impact would surely have been felt in our homeless shelters, on our streets, and throughout our communities. Counties appreciate that the permanent unallotment of child support administrative funding also was not included, and that the Children's and Community Services block grant was reduced at approximately half the level in the governor's budget. However, we do know that this reduction, as it stands, will be very difficult, and it will result in more children at risk for abuse and neglect. Finally, counties have significant concerns about the level of reductions to the children's and adult mental health area. This comes on top of the reductions in the general assistance medical care bill. And if enacted, this change will most certainly compromise the promise in the mental health expansion of a few years. So I have now the opportunity to turn this over to Judith Brumfield, and she and I together will address any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Judith Brumfield. I'm the Deputy Director of Community Services in Scott County, and I'm here today representing counties through AMC and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. I do appreciate the opportunity to comment on House File 2614 on behalf of County Social Services. We do recognize the fiscal constraints under which you're operating and recognize that this budget has been developed in a way that counties must contribute to the solution. That's something we are aware of. We hope that every effort will be made to minimize the impact, especially the permanent impact, on our most vulnerable citizens. I would like to echo what Commissioner Carter said in commending you on not accepting the governor's proposal to eliminate the general assistance program. Cutting this program would show a budget savings while shifting far greater costs to other parts of our support system. This is a population that, by providing some minimal support, we will avoid the incarceration cost or the other long-term cost on the quality of life for all Minnesotans. This bill does readjust the cost shares for the Chemical Dependency Consolidated Fund so that county's maintenance of effort is being eliminated and the county's share is increased marginally. This is a positive change in this bill that we definitely appreciate. It provides more equitable funding plan for all counties and does recognize the extreme disparate impact of the CDMOE on counties. We also appreciate the extension of the SHIP grant and the innovative idea this brings forward in terms of our health care. On the other hand, we have to recognize that, like you, counties are unable to raise funds in this current economic and political climate, along with the levy limits that have been imposed upon counties. We are very concerned about permanent cuts, especially those that will impact the services that we're able to provide to our most vulnerable population. This bill proposes cutting the Adult Mental Health Initiative grants by $6 million annually, and that's an ongoing cost. That cut comes in addition to the previous cut that was made in this particular grant to fund the GA medical care program, and also comes in addition to the unallotment that counties have suffered over the past 2 years in this program. This is a funding source that was established for counties as state hospitals closed, and it was a transfer of funds from housing and state hospitals to enable counties to house this population in the community and provide supports to them. This fund directly pays for housing and support services for adults with severe and persistent mental illness in the community. Without these funds, counties won't be able to continue to pay these rental supports or the employment supports that allow these individuals to live independently in the community. This reduction in services will result in increased hospitalizations, in an inability for these adults to manage their disease, and increased costs in other areas. So while many parts of this bill look toward care coordination as a way to reduce medical costs, this particular cut will actually increase medical costs long-term by rehospitalizing people who could live much less expensively in the community. That's a very clear, direct impact on individuals through this cut in the bill. Another cut that we are very concerned about is the proposed reduction in the Children and Community Services grant, the CCSA grant of $9.9 million. Again, as Ms. Regan spoke, this is in addition to a 30% cut in this grant since 2003. While this looks like a very large unallocated grant, in reality, it's used over 60% to fund child protection services in counties. In Minnesota, we are the state that contributes the very least amount of state money to child protection services of any state in the nation. Minnesota has been a leader in child protection services. We're recognized as having an excellent system. This system is being dismantled. We are going to be unable to provide the most vulnerable individuals in our population with the services they need to survive. If you look in the paper any day of the week, you will see an individual, a child, usually under the age of two, who has been killed by the actions of a parent. These are the children who will not be served if we are unable to continue this particular program. It's ironic that April is Child Protection Month. It's designed to recognize child abuse, child neglect, and to make us all aware of this program. This is the only state funding source provided for the protection and services to these vulnerable children. We cannot afford to not pay attention to this most vulnerable population. These children are our future, and cutting this fund will directly impact the future of our state. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Any questions, members? Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm particularly interested in your last comments regarding child protection. And at some point between now and the end of this process, I would like to know the balance of county dollars levied and directed toward protecting children versus state dollars that are distributed to the 87 county boards of commissioners with child protection directives, or don't want to use the word mandate, but because that this is an area that has to can't continue in this direction.
Thank you.
But the historical tension between county boards of commissioners and their ability and their responsibility to levy for these programs versus the state's role is something that I think we need to get a better handle on. So if you could tell us at some point, I don't expect you to know, have the number today, but in aggregate, what is the county share of child protection services?
Representative Anzel is actually up in Hosh, which is to, you phoned a friend, so he's going to offer some advice.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Anzel, I can't give you the definite dollar amount, but I can give you the rank. Mm-hmm. And Minnesota is ranked 49th in the nation for the state contribution to child protection services. We are only lagged behind, I believe, by the state of Indiana. So we require our counties to pay more than practically every other state in the nation, with the exception of Indiana.
Representative Anzel.
So then it's accurate to say that child protection is primarily funded by local property taxes levied by county boards of commissioners.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Representative, we do have the breakdown of those numbers. I don't have them in front of me, but we can certainly get them back to this committee. The funding is, for child protection, primarily county levy and federal funding that we collect through the medical assistance program. There is a significant amount of state funding, but the primary state funding actually goes to adoption assistance and relative custody assistance. The only state funding that goes to child protection is a CCSA grant. But because it's an undesignated grant, it is not clear when you're looking at budget figures that cutting this grant is cutting the child protection program. But this is the only state funding that is used by counties for child protection.
Representative Anzel.
Now I'm... you've tweaked my interest even further. I would need to know the balance between where the decision making emanates from, and how much authority do county boards of commissioners have to prioritize child protection versus what is done here and at the federal level.
And I think we're not going to go there right now. Maybe you can even go to the hallway right now and have a chat with Ms. Brumfield since she's here. But she'd be happy to come to your office. This
sure.
could be a whole hearing on that
sure.
topic.
Sure.
So
but we'll make sure that.
Sorry to get you off track.
No, it's really a good discussion. The CCSA is the only flexible money that you have to do so many things. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And now we're going to take Sue Abderholden, followed by Carrie and Toby. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI is deeply concerned that our fragile mental health system will be completely broken if your budget is adopted. Your budget breaks our link to community mental health treatment, our link to recovery and resiliency. NAMI Minnesota is frankly outraged that the House is proposing cuts of this magnitude. In nearly every area, the House restored some of the cuts that were proposed by the governor, except in the area of community mental health services, where you've cut an additional $15 million. I want to remind committee members that the General Assistance Medical Care Compromise Bill that was signed into law included cuts to the adult mental health specialty care grants, children's mental health specialty care grants, adult mental health care grants, and you delayed the Youth Act teams. So before we even go through the cuts proposed in this bill, you need to remember that the mental health system lost over $9 million in funding for the remainder of this biennium, and that does not include the loss of GAMC funding for community mental health services, such as assertive community treatment teams, crisis homes, and intensive residential treatment services. Let me point out the devastating cuts you've included in your bill. We reduced children's mental health case management funding by 50%, or $1.2 million each fiscal year for the next 3 years. You eliminate the total funding for all the school-based mental health grants for this fiscal year and the next two fiscal years. This program has provided mental health services to over 6,000 children, 49% of them who have never received services before. These grants improve clinical and functional outcomes for children, increase access to children's mental health services, and make sure that children in regular and special education can be served. You can't do well in school if you're having anxiety attacks, hearing voices, are deeply depressed, or have PTSD. Children with mental illness have the highest dropout rate. The 2007 student survey revealed that over 4,000 sixth grade girls and 5,800 12th grade girls have thought about killing themselves. And nearly 1,300 of the ninth grade girls had actually tried to take their own lives within this past year. And in 2007, 85 of the 571 people who took their lives by suicide in Minnesota were under the age of 24. We need, our children need, school-based mental health services. You eliminate the total funding for intensive community rehab services, which are essentially the ACT teams in the rural areas. You cut the total funding for cultural-specific treatment, and the department had just awarded grants to begin to develop providers in the African-American, Latino, American Indian, and other underserved communities. We have huge mental health disparities in our diverse communities, and this would have helped. You eliminate the total funding for children's mental health respite care. Over 1,000 families received respite care in 2008. Respite care supports parenting, provides for positive peer interactions, reduces the need for out-of-home placements, and builds, strengthens, and supports relationships. You eliminate the total funds for early intervention children's mental health care grants. Early intervention is the key to reverse the effects of adverse early experiences. These funds pay for clinical services for uninsured and underinsured children birth to five, and assist mental health agencies in their communities in building an early childhood mental health infrastructure. Over 635 children have received services, 93.5% were receiving services for the first time, and only 10% had private insurance. You cut the Children and Community Services Block Grant by $9.9 million each of the next 3 years, and this is in addition to the governor's $22 million unallotment. About 16% of those funds go to children's mental health services, and 6% to adult mental health services. So the mental health service system loses another $2.2 million under your proposal. You cut the adult mental health care grants by $6 million each year for the next 3 years, and this is in addition to the $7 million cut in the GAMC bill, representing a 26% cut to these grants. This funding covers mental health treatment of the uninsured, drop-in centers, crisis services, housing, community support programs, ARMS, ERTS, ACTS, and case management. You reduce one total year of funds used to subsidize community hospitals in greater Minnesota that provide inpatient services to people who are dually eligible, are uninsured, or have medical or complex behaviors. These were developed in areas that don't have a community behavioral health hospital, and they actually take people with complex needs. Hospitals impacted include Miller Dwan, Avera, Mesabi, Northwest, St. Cloud, Winona, Cambridge, New Ulm, and Owatonna. Oddly enough, there are no proposed cuts to state-operated services. We were looking at cutting $17 million. Perhaps the cuts to the community hospitals and community-based services is to ensure that people will have to use those empty beds at the community behavioral health hospitals. NAMI never said that state-operated services shouldn't be cut. We said that the redesign process needed to be redesigned. We said that it was okay to close the community behavioral health hospitals that were not being used, but that we shouldn't develop them into something new that also wouldn't be used. It is inconceivable to us that you would make massive cuts to community mental health services where most people are served and no cuts to state-operated services. Between this proposal and the GAMC compromise, we will have lost nearly $53 million in funding for mental health services for this and the next biennium. Remember that we had $34 million in new funding in 2007, the largest amount of new funding in our state's history. Looks like we just made another record, this time in the wrong direction. Our mental health system simply cannot absorb these cuts. You can't make these cuts, obliterate entire programs, and expect them to rebound in 2 years. it will be too late. Have none of you had a family member or close friend who struggled with a mental illness, searching desperately to access community services? You've never had a constituent call you desperate to obtain treatment for their teen with anorexia or husband with bipolar disorder? I fear that the stigma surrounding mental illness persists in this building. You can't see the illness, so it's okay not to fund treatment. If I asked you right now to name 5 slang words for mental illness, you could do it in seconds. Crazy, nuts, psycho. If I asked you right now to name 5 slang words for cancer, you couldn't come up with one if I gave you an hour. Don't push us on the streets. Don't push us into the criminal justice system. Don't push us back into the darkness. We are your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your son, your daughter, your neighbor, your coworker. We deserve to have access to treatment for mental illness as we would for any other illness. You would not think of overtly denying treatment for diabetes, heart disease, or cancer, and so why is it so easy to do it to us? Treat us with the dignity and respect that you afford others. Do not cut those treatment and services that help us be well. Do not ignore our very real illness. Do not forsake us. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Abderholden, I almost really hesitate to say anything. I mean, I think Representative Murphy put it very well before, and I hope you were in the room when she expressed at the outset how really terrible this is for everybody. And I know everybody in this room this is really tough stuff. And I really appreciate your testimony. I appreciate what you handed out, kind of explaining the impact. And, you know, even though I think most of us are at least somewhat aware of the impact, I really appreciate your coming to help us with this. But I really want to ask you and everybody else in the room to please not do the accusation piece, because that makes it so much harder. I mean, I really cannot sit here and listen. I'm sorry. I cannot sit here and listen to 60 or more testifiers say what you just said. And if I have to, I'm telling everybody in the room, I will leave the room. Not because I don't care, but because I just will not sit here and be accused of not caring about this stuff. Okay? We're doing the best we can, and we're happy to know. We're glad to have you help us understand the impact. Please do not accuse us of not caring. A lot of times we don't know. A lot of times we don't understand. All of us care, okay? I hope you all hear that.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you, then, Ms. Abderholden, for your testimony. And next we have Kari Thurlow and Toby Pearson coming together.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers Together. Carrie and I are testifying as a long-term care imperative. We'd like to start by acknowledging the difficult task that you had in front of you. Behind all of the numbers are real people, their lives, their loved ones, and their jobs. We recognize that, and we recognize that it was a very challenging position you were put in. As we continue to strive to keep the promise to our seniors, remember our society's priorities, we'd first like to thank you for taking a few positive steps in the bill. First, we applaud you for including PACE in the bill. PACE, the healthcare home for older adults, and is a positive step forward in older adult services. Second, we appreciate the inclusion of the COLA compensation language. Given that the increases were encumbered, the language is necessary to allow flexibility in response to the cuts. We'd rather not have to ask for this. We'd rather be saying thank you for the increases, but we need the flexibility to respond to the cuts. And finally, we'd like to thank you for including the rehab fixes. As providers who deal with rehab and therapy, we appreciate your efforts in this concern. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Carrie Thurlow, and with Aging Services of Minnesota and the Long-Term Care Imperative. I guess I get to sort of be the bad cop of this sort of duo and talk about the cuts in the bill. We do recognize that the way that you've structured the cuts to older adult services, that being the care centers as well as waivered services, reflects an effort to minimize the harm to providers and the consumers of older adult services. It's a 1% cut that will last for 1 year. And we recognize that this is, as opposed to the option put on the table by the governor's bill, is a more palatable way of doing the cut. But we would be remiss if we weren't here coming to represent our members. And our members are concerned about the cuts and do still have cuts, concerns about the 1% cut. I just need to remind you that a cut to a nursing home, for every dollar that the state saves, will result in actually $3 lost to a care center, because you're also losing federal matching funds, and it's also resulting in loss of private pay dollars. As a result, even a 1% cut has a triple effect on care centers. And we've come to you before. I don't need to remind you that care centers in the state of Minnesota are in deep financial stress. So I can't come here and necessarily predict to you what is going to happen to each specific care center here in Minnesota. Our members do remain concerned about dealing even with this temporary cut. Also, the cuts to waivered services, in particular, our members deal most closely with alternative care program and the elderly waiver program. We're very concerned about the impact of a cut on access to home and community-based services, which are, as we've testified before, an extremely cost-effective way of providing older adult services and an extremely cost-effective way of meeting the needs of seniors in places that they would rather receive their long-term care. So we remain concerned about that. I also want to make the point that we are concerned that there is very little in the way of long-term care financing reform in this bill. As we look to the future, we do, as we've said before, need to change the system of incentives and disincentives so that we as a population begin to plan for and save for our long-term care needs, and so that individuals are taking personal responsibility for their long-term care needs. A phase-out of rate equalization would have been a step towards reform, and we encourage folks to consider that issue as we look to improving the bill as this moves through the process. We believe that a phase-out of rate equalization would be a step towards long-term care reform, certainly not the only step towards long-term care reform, but as we look to the future, a very important, necessary step. So with that, I think Toby and I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee would have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you both, Ms. Thurlow and Toby, for being here today and testifying. I just wanted to make a comment about the rate equalization and that I strongly oppose that. That, again, for people my age, 65 and older, going into the nursing homes who would be paying privately would put me on MA faster. And I don't think that that is a responsible, constructive way to fund the nursing homes. And I do want to also add, that for three times now since I've been elected, I have tried to find a revenue stream for our nursing homes that is that would be beneficial and that would be there for the long run. And that, of course, would have been the fair taxation of those folks who are making $250,000, $500,000 a year, and to direct that money towards our nursing homes and those disabled people. I continue to work in that area and will continue to work for that proposal in the next biennium. However, the fix with the rate equalization, removing that would harm those of us who have saved our money, paid our homes off, and have a little bit left to bury ourselves and pay our way to the nursing home. But the way it is now with the rate being the same as MA is the best way for those of us, and there are a lot of us that would be affected by that. And I just wanted to make that clear.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And next, we have Maureen McConnell. And Jessica Webster.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm the Advocacy Director at the Legal Services Advocacy Project, and I'm with my colleague Jessica Webster. I'm going to talk about the health care cuts, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jessica to talk about the economic assistance aspects of the bill. First, we'd like to say thank you for your work in restoring dental services and moderating the cuts to the therapies. Also, to maintaining coverage of childless adults above 75% of the federal poverty guideline on MinnesotaCare, and for adopting the early medical assistance expansion. With respect to the early medical assistance expansion, we hope that the date can be moved forward from January 1st, as it is in the bill, or that in the alternative, for the time period from June 1 until December 31st, the current GMC population could remain on the fee-for-service system. We are concerned about what is going to start to happen to that population on June 1st, given the difficulty in implementing the CCDS concept. So we would hope, we are supportive of the new payment arrangements in the bill and think that the department should be shifting resources and trying to work on developing those concepts instead of the CCDS that was a part of the GMC solution. And so we would, again, we're very concerned about the disruption to patient care that will happen starting June 1st, and would hope that either the expansion date could be moved forward from January 1, 2011, or in the alternative, a fee-for-service system could be maintained until the medical assistance expansion can happen. Also, a final note, as we move forward with healthcare reform and as new payment arrangements are developed, we hope that there will be ample opportunities for consumers, patients, and the providers that serve the public program recipients to participate in reform efforts. We are strongly supportive of the new payment arrangements and think that they will benefit by having all stakeholders involved in the process. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm also with Legal Aid. Just to speak to the MFIP and economic assistance portions of the bill, first, we're very grateful that you did not take the governor's cut to general assistance. We're very grateful that you did not impose an SSI penalty, and we appreciate, as members of the Stand Together Minnesota Coalition that are also here today, that you have recognized these are poorest and most vulnerable Minnesotans, and we really appreciate that. We'd also like to thank Representative Fritz and the committee for bringing a provision in this bill that will remove a barrier and expand access to federal food support for 70,000 Minnesotans. It's critical at this time of high unemployment and job loss that we make this available to these families. And finally, just to express some concern and some disappointment at the $28 million that's refinanced in TANF. We're not coming to express disappointment just for this $28 million. This $28 million has been taken from low-income families at a time when we've taken more than $400 million in the last 10 years from low-income families. We're cutting low-income families at a time that we've taken $400 million in federal TANF money from low-income families. And we think that we wouldn't have to make those cuts if we use these funds for the purposes for which they were intended. Thank you very much.
One final note. I just wanted to express for the record that Legal Aid is also very concerned about the mental health, the cuts to community mental health services that Ann Henry and Sue Abderholden have already testified to. So in order to be brief, I'm not going to, I just want to echo their comments and that we share their concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for your testimony. Next is Steve Larson.
Thank you so much for having us. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Kurt Rutson, and I want to thank you immensely for the monies allocated for the Vision 10 program in Rochester, Minnesota. I was the past chair of that board, and as many of you know, that's very, very important money being used down there, and a lot of people being helped in a program that's in dire need and needs to be saved, and we go a long way for people with disabilities. One other thing I would love to add before I turn it over to Steve here is I know you all care very, very, very much, and I can't tell you how much that means to me. I know you guys are doing the best job you can, but I just want to remind myself every day that until we get passing beyond our own noses, I mean, what's good for me and stop caring about others, nothing's gonna get done. I appreciate your time and your consideration.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARCA Minnesota and co-chair of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. And just to add on to what Kurt said in regards to quality assurance, we want to thank you for your support of that and also let you know that we will be coming with a comprehensive statewide proposal about building a community-based quality assurance system for Minnesotans with disabilities for the 2011 session. In preparation for this hearing, we had news conferences in several cities in Minnesota, including Moorhead, Rochester, Fairmont, Duluth, Waite Park, which I believe is between St. Cloud and St. Joseph, and St. Paul. And at those news conferences, we had no trouble soliciting individuals with disabilities and their family members to come and testify about the cumulative impact that cuts have had in the past several years. And there was particular testimony in regards to the lack of dental services and accessibility, and so we thank you for addressing this issue in House File 2614 in regards to the therapies, including the importance of physical therapy to help persons with disabilities work and live in the community. And we want to thank you for minimizing the rates cuts to programs for persons with disabilities. We are concerned with the limitations on waiver growth, 6 slots per month for persons with developmental disabilities, and our waiting list continues. There's 4,000 people on that. The CADI waiver, which serves many people with diagnosis of mental illness, is also limited, and we're concerned about those waiver cuts, as well as the increased premium for MAEPD. And we strongly support the statements that Sue Abderholden and other people have identified as far as the impact of the proposed cuts in the mental health programs. In addition to the challenges that we just talked about, there are the cumulative impact that Representative Murphy wanted to hear about in regards to past cuts. And during the news conferences, we heard a lot of concern about those programs or the PCA cuts that are being made and those people that are going to lose PCA services. And coupled with some of the proposals in this bill, it's going to be very problematic in the community. I want to let you know that we are committed to a planning process beginning as soon as this legislative session is over on how we can maintain a community-based service system during a time when we will have fewer resources. And we're up to the challenge and look forward to working with you on those issues in preparation for another difficult legislative session in 2011. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mr. Larson. You know, I think as I've been doing the crude math over the past biennium, if this bill were enacted as it is now, it would total about an accumulated about $2 billion worth of cuts in health and human services in just the past 3 years. And I know that the people for whom you are advocating are experiencing that in a real way in their lives. And I think as we're listening to people testify today, we're not really managing anymore. As the administration likes to say, we can manage this. I know people across the state of Minnesota are struggling as we come out of the recession, but there are people that are vulnerable, and they're really feeling the impact in the way they lead their lives, and that $2 billion of accumulated cuts in health and human services are taking their toll. So I am grateful to hear that you're going to do planning. I think that's important, and we want to help you with that, but I don't want to gloss over the middle part of your testimony and the impact that people are feeling in their lives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank all the testifiers so far and the testifiers who are going to come up. I agree with Representative Murphy. We need to hear the impact of these cuts and proposed changes always. That's very important. I appreciate Representative Liebling's comments earlier, too. I would be remiss not to offer another perspective, and that is a reminder of what we come back to next year. Projections are with inflation maybe $7 billion in deficit. And I think on a bipartisan basis, most of us understand we need to turn around our economy in order to change this. If we want the resources to take care of people in need, we must be about turning around our economy. And that's got to be more than just talk or slogans on a news piece. So all of us need to be about trying to do that. Economic development is going to be what turns this around and gets us back to where we have the resources to care for people in need. As tough as this is, $7 billion next year is inconceivable. I can't imagine. And I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just to address the comments from Representative Murphy and Representative Gottwell, yes, we realize that that's the challenge ahead of us, and we're overwhelmed by it too, but the way to deal with that, I think, is to start talking as soon as we can. And just one last point, and that is at the ARCA Minnesota website, we do have the newspaper articles and the TV coverage available from individuals around the state articulating their concerns about the issues we're talking about today. And so I just urge you to review those. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Next is James Hadigan from Gillette Children's. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Hundley. I will try to be brief. I know that we've got a lot of other people ready to testify. I've been here before this committee now several times this session for different topics. Gillette Children's, as you know, is a hospital that deals with children with disabilities. We started out life as a state hospital. We've been around for over 100 years. We see kids from every county in the state every single year. I will quickly go into the impact of the reductions, but with the caveat that we've only had 12 hours to look at the bill, and I'm not sure of everything that's in there that might affect us, but the numbers that are being passed out to you show what I've seen so far. And I'm just going to quickly, I'm a financial person, so I'm going to talk finances first. We budgeted a $12.1 million loss on our Medicaid business this year, which is just shy of about 8% of our total revenue. We don't get anywhere near cost already with the reductions in disproportionate share that happened as part of the GMC legislation, and then these proposed reductions, that's another $3 million that will come our way this year, taking our losses to over $15 million, 10% of our total revenue. It's getting very, very tough to absorb. That's shown actually on the second page of the handout. The first page shows you our concern about these cuts is not the cuts in isolation, but cumulative effect. As you can see, in 2002, the state paid its bills to us. We were paid essentially 100% of cost. Over 8 years, we have now gotten down to pretty much just a bit over half of cost being paid. And that's that has effects on us, effects on our programs. And now, as a, I'll stop talking as a financial person for a second and say the real question, I think, before us and before the legislature is you know, what do these cuts, that first graph in particular, what does it do to those services to kids? Again, we see kids in every county every year. We are not in a position, and no hospital, I think, is, to just cut services to kids who have Medicaid. If you need to cut costs, you're going to cut services or programs across the board. And so it affects not just children with Medicaid, but it will affect every child in Minnesota who needs our services. I thought I'd be brief with that. I'll take any questions.
Questions for Mr. Hadigan? Don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Jonathan Watson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm the Director of Public Policy with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the 17 federally qualified health centers in the state that serve 180,000 patients. Roughly 40% of our patients are uninsured, and another 40% are on a public program. I'm here today to, we're grateful for your efforts to at least maintain our small portion of the healthcare safety net in the state of Minnesota, and I'll go through a few points in the bill that do indeed do that. The first is the community health center appropriation, which is level funded under the bill. The governor cuts that by about $1 million, and that translates to about 1,500 folks, the cost for 1,500 folks to serve them. So that's the impact of the governor's cut on that. But with your maintaining those dollars, we use those funds to do a variety of projects, offset some of the costs of their uninsured, to diabetes prevention programs in the American Indian community, and to hire, frankly, staff to meet the increasing demand for our services. Again, we saw 11% increase in the uninsured last year. So a lot of these funds help us go hire dentists, mental health workers, community health workers, and those sorts of folks. The second piece is one of the unfortunate consequences of the GMC law was our 6,000 GMC folks that we serve on an annual basis essentially become uninsured as of June 1st for the most part. There is a provision in there in line 845 in the spreadsheet that it gives community health centers roughly $2.5 million to offset partially offset the cost of continuing to serve the GMC folks. As you know, we never turn anyone away for care at a community health center, so those funds help, again, partially offset the cost of serving them. The third piece is the modifications of the Critical Access Dental Provider Program that Representative Julie Bunn worked on. In a good way, there is a provision in there that allows community health centers to maintain their designation since 40% of our patients are clearly uninsured and or on a public program. So we maintain our ability to continue to receive critical access dental payments. And beyond that, it also funds or keeps designation for a lot of our safety net dental colleagues as well. Keep them receiving payments. Right now, we have about a six-month wait at a community health center for dental services. If some of our dental colleagues went out of business, it'd probably be a 12 to 18-month wait. So it's just a capacity issue, and we recognize that. A lot of people have talked fourthly here about the early adopter of Medicaid, and again, we're a strong supporter of that. Right now, as I said, 40% of our patients are uninsured. We look at probably about 20,000 of our patients could benefit from that early adopter provision, and that would just reduce our proportion of uninsured down to 25%, which frankly we would be thrilled with. The last piece I want to talk about is a concern with the accountable care organizations. It's pretty undefined in my mind, at least at this point, but I think that's an advantage for Minnesota that we can set up these accountable care organizations to emphasize primary care. And my recommendation would be, and I think others have said today, that any task force or any work that goes on with these ACOs over the course of the summer before next session really involve stakeholders such as primary care providers, such as community health centers. So those are my comments today, and I can stand for any questions.
Questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you're the right person to answer this, but if we were able to do the early adoption of the MA, to what degree would that backfill some of the cuts to mental health?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I am not the correct person to answer that question. I'm sorry, I can't. I think other folks from the mental health community would speak to that.
Okay, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Watson, we've talked before about the community health centers and their potential for perhaps playing a role in these ACOs or CCOs. Not that we want to go on for a long time about it, but do you see the changes to ACOs and CCOs, there would be a role there for the CHCs, that we could do a better job for some of these people in need under those models than we're currently doing by kind of letting you be unto yourself?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, yes, I do see the opportunity. I think the provision that's cited actually in the bill under the ACOs, the Section 3022 of the Federal Healthcare Reform Law now, it is my impression that that piece of the bill requires ACOs to contract with what are called essential community providers, as the federal government defines them. And community health centers do fit. They're one of the providers that fit under that criteria. So we're optimistic that if this is the carrot, that indeed primary care providers, all primary care providers, and community health centers would be involved in those systems, if you will.
Other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Liebling's question, I was getting hand signals from some of the folks in the audience. So I think that if we were to do an early adoption of MA, it would stabilize, I think, in many ways, some of the cuts that are being made in the budget, because there would be more uniform coverage for outpatient care in community clinics or other outpatient clinics and for hospital care. And so there is an impact on the care of the mentally ill by that stabilization. And further, I think if we're able to pair the movement into or the early adoption of MA with the reform that's being described in this bill, we could really wring savings out of the system, which I think would help us in the out years that Representative Gottwald's talking about. Mm-hmm. So I do think that while there's a lot of pain in this bill, there is a potential for some movement that could help us both in a budgetary way as a state and for a lot of the providers and for the people who are getting their care there.
Well, thank you, Mr. Watson.
Thank you.
Next is Dick Dirks from the Dental Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dick Dirks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Dental Association. The Minnesota Dental Association represents 3,500 dentists and dentists in training in Minnesota. I would like to speak to four important dental issues in the bill. First, the Critical Access Dental Provider Program is instrumental in providing dental care to low-income persons. This additional reimbursement that dental clinics receive for treating substantial numbers of MHCP patients is critical for maintaining the dental safety net. The Minnesota Dental Association supports the partial restoration of dental critical access funding from the governor's unallotment last year to help maintain dental safety net clinics. And this legislation was brought forward, as you know, by Representative Bunn in House File 3269 and has been advanced in this bill. Unfortunately, in order to still save money, the bar has been raised in this bill in order to qualify for critical access dental funding, and many important safety net dental clinics will still be potentially washed out of the program, by raising the bar for qualifying for critical access to 40% of a dental clinic's patient encounters from the current 20%. Many important safety dental net clinics, especially in greater Minnesota, may lose eligibility, and we just hope that they can survive until more normal levels of funding can be restored. There is some discretion in the bill for the Department of Human Services to address this with a 60-mile, 60-radius opportunity, and we hope that that will help to mitigate the impact of the 40% threshold that is in the bill. Second, we support the partial restoration of the dental benefit set for adults. Last year, as a budget-cutting move, the adult benefit set was severely limited. The inclusion of Representative Bunn's House File 3269 in the omnibus bill will pick up a few key dental procedures that were noticeably absent from the benefit set established last year, and this is important to do. However, the adult benefit set will remain extremely limited, even if this legislation passes, and we will hope to restore a comprehensive dental benefit set for adults in the future. Third, the Minnesota Dental Association greatly appreciates the fact that the House continues the operation of the SOS dental clinics in Fergus Falls, Willmar, Brainerd, Cambridge, and Faribault. by not allowing these dental clinics to be closed, as was proposed by DHS and as will occur on a temporary basis at the end of this week, developmentally disabled individuals will not be abandoned for their dental care. Good oral health is particularly necessary for these individuals to maintain good oral health, and most of them would not be able to find alternative dental homes. And fourth, the Minnesota Dental Association appreciates that this bill does not eliminate the donated dental services program as was recommended by the governor. The donated dental services program provides $15 worth of free, in other words, donated dental care from a dentist for each dollar spent. The state dollars do not have to actually pay for any care. They only pay to coordinate care between the patient, the dentist, the dental lab, and the social service agency. Elderly and disabled patients who do not have the financial ability to pay for the dental care they need and who are not covered by the MHCP programs are the individuals who will continue to benefit by the continuation of the donated dental services program. Over 400 dentists are active volunteers in this program. The dollars are very small, but the payback is huge. I thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Questions? I don't see any. So thank you for your testimony. And next is Dr. Tim Burkett and Rick Stein. Are they here? I don't see them, so we'll probably hear from them later. Sherry Knuth and Jane Okramowitz and Lynn Zimmerman and Kathy Sarah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Zimmerman, and I'm the Director of Common Sense Services and a board member of the Minnesota and the National Adult Day Services Associations. I'm speaking on behalf of seniors and workers for quality. I would like to thank the chair and the members for their strong effort to soften the 2.5% reduction proposed by the governor with a one-time, one-year cut with restoration of funding to the current level in 1 year. We do appreciate that very much. I remain concerned, however, because the 1% reduction comes on top of so many cuts and so few cost of living adjustments in the past 8 years. We are trying to deliver year 2010 services with rates that resemble year 2002. It's no wonder that we're having a harder time than ever hiring and retaining quality staff to deliver quality care. And unfortunately, every time an employee leaves an adult day center, it takes at least $1,500 to advertise, hire, and train a new worker. The Minnesota Adult Day Services Association surveyed members twice since the 2009 cuts and identified struggles shared by all. How do we maintain the necessary and mandated staff to client ratios while staffing, staff wages, and benefits are either frozen or reduced? And how do we sustain choices and options that provide the support needed for vulnerable adults to access services and remain in their homes? Seniors and Workers for Quality aim to ensure quality care and quality jobs. These quality jobs can exist in a nursing facility, community service, or care provided in the home. If this were the first reduction in recent years, we could add potatoes to the soup and economize. But the changes we will have to make this year transforms our soup into a thin and rather bitter gruel. Sorry nourishment, indeed, for our staff and the people they serve. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members of the committee and Mr. Chairman, my name is Kathy Krieger-Serra. My remarks pertain to the rate equalization law for long-term care nursing facilities. My purpose in talking to you today is to tell you about the experience I had 11 years ago in Cleveland, Ohio, when I was looking for a nursing home for my 94-year-old father. To assist me and my elderly mother in this endeavor, I hired a geriatric nurse case manager. We looked at several homes in the Cleveland metropolitan area. The nurse case manager was glad to learn that my parents had substantial savings and that we could present my father to nursing home administrators as a private pay patient. The nurse case manager informed me that if my father were to try to enter a nursing home as a Medicaid patient, we would have to look far beyond the Cleveland metropolitan area, a drive of 1 to 1.5 hours from my parents' home, in order to find a facility that would be willing to admit a Medicaid patient. My understanding is that the state of Ohio, unlike Minnesota, did not have a rate equalization law and does not have one now. Because of this, people in Ohio experienced discrimination upon entry based upon their ability to pay for their care. Those people who could enter a nursing home paying out of pocket for their care could work to select the best home from among those that had available spaces. However, those who entered a home as a Medicaid patient had to take the leftovers. It is my understanding that because of the unequal payment rates for private pay and Medicaid patients, nursing homes which accept private pay and Medicaid funding prefer to have residents enter as private pay rather than Medicaid. It appears that under these conditions, it would be particularly tempting for for-profit nursing homes to refuse entry to Medicaid patients, even though they will take Medicaid funds after the private pay person runs out of money. My father was able to enter a nursing home in the Cleveland metropolitan area close to my parents' home because he was a private pay patient. I've been a resident of Minnesota since 1981. Based on my experience and my observations in Ohio, a state lacking rate equalization for long-term nursing care facilities, I urge the legislature to maintain Minnesota's wise policy of equalizing nursing home rates for private pay and Medicaid patients.
Thank you. Any questions? And I just have to comment, the reason we're so few members here is not because they don't want to be here, but we have about four other committees going on at the same time.
Conference committee.
That's where a lot of these people are. Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just point out, this has come up a couple of times. The whole rate equalization, keeping it or not keeping it, underscores a larger issue, and we've talked about this on a bipartisan basis in this committee and the policy committee about the need. As we're looking at reforms and maybe some of these deficits we're facing move us towards thinking more innovatively about how we help people begin to save a little bit more for their own retirement instead of defaulting to MA or defaulting to some other program. We have a crisis of a lot of people in need and not a lot of funding for the facilities they're going to be in. And so we need to be doing kind of all of the above. So as we're talking about these things financially and otherwise, we need to be thinking about how we encourage and incent people to save up their own personal resources as much as possible for long-term care.
Could I make a comment regarding
sure.
that? Well, my father entered a nursing home at age 94. He was born in 1906. He worked his entire life and for AT&T until 1972 when he retired. My parents were very careful in saving money and did save money and had investments and so forth. But just to give you a picture of what happens with finances when you pay for nursing homes. My mother died before he did, so she was not in a home. He had a year or two of home daycare, which was relatively inexpensive. He entered a nursing home in Ohio for a year. Then I brought him to Minnesota when my mother died, and he was in a home for 5 years here. His assets were over $500,000, over $500,000. Those assets were gone in 6 years. Mm-hmm. So.
Representative Gawel, do you want to respond?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want to turn this into a long debate, but we've talked about the need for, we have a paltry incentive right now for people to purchase long-term care coverage in this state, and not that that's the entire answer. But we need to start thinking about how people save up resources. Not that those resources will cover all the years, but we also cannot keep going the route we're going because the costs are going to increase at a rate that simply will be unsustainable.
Well,
good morning, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make one comment, too, in that regard, that, you know, don't penalize those of us who have saved our money for our nursing home care. Some of us have saved $100,000, and that would be the equity of our homes and our property included in that, plus the savings that we have been able to put away as well towards that. But I think that $100,000 is not enough. I think we probably need $200,000. So I would advise the folks your age, Representative Gottwald and younger, to start saving.
Amen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jane Okramovich. I serve as president of Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition, and I am a volunteer advocate with the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota chapter. My testimony also today will focus on the merits of rate equalization law in Minnesota, and I certainly want to thank the committee, particularly those of you who work so hard, for not including in this particular bill the repeal of rate equalization. But the reason we still want to address this today is we know that amendments may be forthcoming and it may be at any point in this progress through the House. When I heard Mr. McAvee testify before the Health Care and Human Services Policy Committee back on March the 11th about his wife's care cost, I started calculating the financial toll that private pay individuals now incur. I did this partly to see if I will have the resources to pay for an extended stay in a skilled care facility. If the governor's proposed phase-in rate increases were to be adopted by the House, it will mean more sacrifices for the generation that scrimped and saved for their retirement. Mr. McAvee stated that the current monthly care figure for his wife is $6,900. Of which their long-term care insurance pays just $2,700. The proposed 2% increase in the first year of rate equalization repeal would be $138 a month. That may not sound outlandish until we realize that it amounts up to $1,556 per year, and it would total $4,668 in 3 years if it stayed at the 2% increase. However, the proposal offers it to be raised to 6% in 3 years. This amounts to nearly a whole month's cost of care. I was astounded when I realized that the McAfees are now paying $82,800 a month now. A year. They're paying $82,800 for the year. The McAfees are fortunate to have long-term care insurance coverage, but not everyone can obtain it because of health issues and, in particular, its cost. I have had my long-term care policy for 12 years and have paid, over that period of time, $19,320 for this coverage, which will not likely cover my cost of care in a long-term care setting, and I shudder to think how quickly my depleted IRA will be used up if I need skilled care. I'd like to remind the committee that nursing home residents who are there with a form of dementia are not short-term stay. They are going to need a higher level of care for years, not months. My mother's care is an example of that fact. I do thank you for the opportunity to express my concerns about a proposal that may be likely to be reintroduced during the debate on where to find some additional funds for nursing homes. Repealing rate equalization will not really help in the long run. However, it will cause great distress to our seniors and their caregivers. And I thank you for all of your efforts.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any. So thank you for your testimony. Rick Varco and Donna Quinn.
No, John Cheetah.
Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me.
I think you skipped one.
Yeah, John Cheetah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and many members. John Cheetah from Courage Center. A couple of things in the bill that we are thankful for. First and foremost, the preservation of rehabilitation therapies. And to Representative Bunn in particular, while this is not an ideal situation, we thank the committee members for recognizing that while this is an optional service, this is also one of the critical tools for achieving positive health outcomes for individuals with complex needs, especially those with newly acquired conditions and those with existing conditions who need to maintain their level of independence and functioning. The direction that the bill moves in terms of health reform, both adopting what's happening at the federal level, but also a couple of opportunities that the state is taking advantage of. Those are in Article 2, Sections 22 and 23. The first takes an intensive care coordination approach toward those with the most complex needs, and I think that's moving in a very positive direction. The second pilot moving towards special populations. Again, these are trying to take some of the most complicated folks, some of our most expensive to serve, and put them into alternative financing arrangements, much like the Accountable Care Organization. The beauty of this that we hope from a disability perspective is that this provides incentives for providers at different points on the health continuum to work together to achieve a positive outcome that hopefully will move us away from the tyranny of the individual service, both in providing flexibility of payment but also flexibility in achieving a health outcome and how we get there. Directly related to that, the task force that you're looking to establish, Mr. Chairman, to have a more transparent and thoughtful approach toward implementing health reform. While we know it's always tricky to put these panels together and have equal representation, we would love to see a consumer representative on that panel as well. So hope that we can include that in the committee's composition. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Cheetah? I don't see any, so again, thank you for your testimony. And now we'll go to Rick Varco and Donna Quinn.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I'm the political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent about 17,000 healthcare workers around the state. I'll be very brief. One, I'd like to thank you for your hard work putting the budget together and alleviating some of the proposed cuts. I'd also like to particularly thank you for your creativity in going after additional federal resources. You've heard the testimony. I think we all agree that these are some pretty hard cuts, and to me it illustrates the need to enlarge the pie and for greater revenue. And that's only going to happen if people understand the impact of these some of these proposed cuts. So with that, I would like to take it turn it over to somebody who knows firsthand what it's like to work in a Minnesota nursing home.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Donna Quinn. I am a licensed practical nurse, and for the last 10 years, I have worked at a nursing home in South St. Paul. I am proud to work with some of the most dedicated caregivers in Minnesota, but dedication goes only so far. Chronic underfunding means low staffing levels. Sometimes